What will Biden do? Biden is stuck, and he needs a way out. Just like he has said in the past that Putin needs a way out. Everybody needs an off-ramp on this right now, and the off-ramp has to come from the negotiating table. The Chinese proposal is basically a set of principles to say, let's sit down and start talking. But we, the American people, have to put more pressure on our government, or it's going to be a long war of attrition that could explode into a much, much more disastrous Third World War.
Medea Benjamin, we want to thank you for being with us, co-founder of Code Pink, co-author of the new book, War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict. We'll link to your new article, Pentagon Leaks Punch a Hole in the U.S. Propaganda War. And again, Juan will be giving the keynote address at 10 a.m. Eastern Time at American University, talking about the search for a new U.S. policy for a new Latin America, burying 200 years of the Monroe Doctrine. Joining him in that day-long conference will be Medea Benjamin, Nick Estes, and others. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
I down all in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for radically democratic news, views, reviews, and interviews, stories of ordinary and extraordinary people working to root down the oppressive institutions of capitalism. That's the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday mornings at 9.
Connect with your favorite community radio station on social media.
Our Facebook page is facebook.com/kboomradio.
And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/kboo.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/kboo radio.
We also provide content to the free music archive.
An interactive library of high-quality legal audio downloads.
That's at freemusicarchive.org/curator/kboo.
You can find all of this and more on the KBOO website, kboo.fm.
Thanks for listening.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, a special in-depth cross-generational discussion with Gwendolyn Zohara Simmons and Ashley Henderson. Gwendolyn was active in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I call her Zohara. And Ashley Henderson, who refers to herself as a Black Appalachian working class woman out of Southeast Tennessee and the first Black woman to serve as the co-executive director of the Highlander Research and Education Center, and is an active participant in the movement for Black lives. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. President Biden is planning to announce new steps to protect South Korea from the threat of its northern neighbor. Biden and South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol are set to sign an agreement, including plans to have U.S. nuclear-armed submarines dock in South Korea for the first time in more than 40 years. That's according to administration officials. There's growing worry in Seoul about North Korean nuclear threats. Today's announcement of the dock visit is a key element of what's called the Washington Declaration, aimed at deterring North Korea from attacking its neighbor. The agreement also seeks to ward off South Korea from restarting its own nuclear program. The declaration is being unveiled as President Biden hosts Yoon for a state visit in Washington. U.S. officials say the Taliban have killed the Islamic State group militant who spearheaded the suicide bombing at the Kabul airport that killed 13 U.S. service members and about 170 Afghans during the chaotic U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan in August 2021. Initially, neither the U.S. nor apparently the Taliban were aware that the mastermind was dead. Officials say he was killed during a series of battles early this month in southern Afghanistan between the Taliban and the Islamic State group's affiliate. But in the past few days, U.S. intelligence confirmed with high confidence that the Islamic State leader had been killed. Millions have been displaced by fighting in Sudan between the army and a rival paramilitary group. Foreign governments have been racing to evacuate their nationals as the security situation in the African nation deteriorates. More from FSN's John Beaver.
Thousands have left by road, air, and sea in the last few days. The UN is warning of a growing humanitarian crisis as those who remain face food shortages and limited access to clean water. Over 200 UK nationals were evacuated from Sudan on rescue flights, according to the Foreign Office. The UK's response for nationals in Sudan that aren't diplomats has been criticised as slower than some other countries. But Defence Secretary Ben Wallace has rejected that.
Yeah, we went in exactly the same time as the French, but we went into the city, picked up people and then took them to the airfield, whereas the French went to the airfield and then went into the city. So this sort of sense of we were all behind everyone, not the case, except, yes, you're right, at the beginning we took out, like the Americans, the diplomats and their families. That was the decision.
From Feature Story News in the UK, I'm John Beaver.
House Republicans made changes overnight to their sweeping debt ceiling package to win over GOP holdouts. Speaker Kevin McCarthy is struggling to round up the votes for the bill, which would tie an increase in the country's debt ceiling with restrictions on federal spending. A House committee took up the bill Tuesday. Christopher Martinez reports.
Republicans defended the cuts. Republican Jody Arrington of Texas is chair of the House Budget Committee.
There is a lot of waste. There is a lot of woke. And there is a lot of bloat in this government, and we got to get to cutting and reducing it.
He calls the Republican bill the first step to getting our fiscal house in order.
Time to tap the brakes on Washington spending.
It does not have a realistic chance of becoming law. President Joe Biden has said he'll veto it if it should somehow pass out of the Democrat majority Senate. But Republicans are hoping it brings Biden to the negotiating table for a deal to repeal some of Biden's recent legislative victories. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
As California's Central Valley braces this week for the possibility of flooding from record levels of Sierra snowmelt, Governor Gavin Newsom and state officials toured the region Tuesday to survey preparation efforts. Newsom said state and local officials are working together to get ahead of the expected heavy runoff.
This requires cross-jurisdictional engagement, county to county, city to city, so many different boards, so many different administrators, so many different points of view, so many people saying, you pay for it, I benefit, and we're assessing all that. I just want people protected and property protected, and we'll do what we can to intervene as appropriate.
The Tulare Lake Basin could be particularly at risk of flooding. The lake, which has been dry for more than a century, is reappearing with all the extra water from heavy winter rains and the appearance of spring snow runoff. Newsom said evacuation protocols are already in place for the region. Meanwhile, Yosemite National Park officials closed the park until Friday ahead of expected flooding. I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
Those were our news headlines, and today a very special in-depth conversation that I've been very much looking forward to. And just to put our conversation in some context, because we'll be talking about we'll be looking backwards to look forward, some of the civil rights era and where we are now and some of the challenges facing those of us who are working specifically in Black communities, but also generally across the board on human and civil rights. And some of the historic context, the Reconstruction era was 1863 to 1877 in U.S. history. And of course, the 14th Amendment of the Constitution gave Black men allegedly full citizenship, although I think we have yet to see full citizenship, and promise equal protection under the law. Now, Reconstruction, however, ended pretty much when the North pulled troops out of the South, and it really gave rise to the Jim Crow era. You know, in 1786, there was a disputed presidential election between Democratic candidate Samuel Tilden and Republican candidate Rutherford B. Hayes. And then a year later, the Compromise of 1877 was passed, where the Democrats agreed that Rutherford B. Hayes would become president in exchange for the withdrawal of federal troops from the South and the granting of home rule in the South. And of course, you know, you saw the Jim Crow era coming up, the series of lynchings that had been going on and continued, Jim Crow laws that repressed the Black vote, and did a number of measures, from killing people to a property test, to purges, to racist prisons, and more, to keep Black people from voting. And there are a number of martyrs of that civil rights era. And we'll be talking about all of that with our guests. But to also just set the stage a bit more for us for this discussion, I wanted to share a couple of clips, one from the civil rights era from with Bayard Rustin, another from the free speech movement, and the beginnings of the anti-war movement that happened at UC Berkeley. That's a short piece from Mario Savio. And then we're fast-forwarding until today, where we'll be hearing from a 92-year-old Black grandmother who was not allowed to vote in Georgia in the recent midterm elections, and the Reverend William Barber, who is the joint coordinator of the new Poor People's Campaign, picking up where the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King left off. So let's go to that right now and then welcome our guests and go to the discussion.
Now, my friends, the problem has been from the very founding of this nation that we made a separation between individual morality and social ethics, and we are still continuing to do so. Thomas Jefferson awoke one night after having a horrible dream in which he saw the nation being torn asunder over the problem of slavery. He behaved as an individual moralist and as one not at all concerned with social ethics. He got up the next morning and wrote a will in which he manumitted his slaves upon his death. What he should have done was to have seen the problem as a social problem, and he should have gone into the Congress of the United States to have done something about the problem of slavery politically, rather than merely to have solved his conscience.
We have an autocracy, which runs this university. It's managed. We were told the following: if President Kerr actually tried to get something more liberal out of the regents in his telephone conversations, why didn't he make some public statement to that effect? And the answer we received from a well-meaning liberal was the following. He said, would you ever imagine the manager of a firm making a statement publicly in opposition to his board of directors? That's the answer. Well, I ask you to consider, if this is a firm, and if the board of regents are the board of directors, and if President Kerr in fact is the manager, then I tell you something, the faculty are a bunch of employees, and we're the raw materials. But we're a bunch of raw materials that don't mean to be have any process upon us, don't mean to be made into any product, don't mean to end up being bought by some clients of the university, be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone. We're human beings. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Has this ever happened to you before?
Never.
How long have you been voting?
All my life, ever since I was old enough. But I've been voting right here, ever since 1968.
Yeah. And it's just, it's horrible. And I say that because the West End, she's been in this community back when we could, when they were doing sit-ins. She held civil rights meetings in her home. And today to come out and not be able to vote and no one can give you an explanation, like, it's extremely emotional and it bothers me. It bothers me to my core. Like, there's actually no record of her whatsoever voting in any election whatsoever, and it's ridiculous. I'm sorry.
Trump is a symptom of a greater moral malady. And his election is as American as apple pie. It has happened before. If you don't believe it, go back to 1877. When a guy ran for president and lost the popular vote, cut a deal with the Electoral College and said, if you put me in, I'll pull the troops out of the South, I'll help end Reconstruction, and I'll change the Supreme Court. They did, he did, and by 1883, the Civil Rights Act of 1875 was overturned. White supremacy was recodified into the laws of this land. So anybody that tells you we've never seen this before, either they don't know history or they haven't had their eyes open. Neil Painter, the great historian at Princeton, has said there is this thing in American, the American project, called call and response. There is a call for more justice and more equity and more racial equity. But then there's always a backlash, a response. We're not here tonight just because of that, because if President Obama had had four more years, or even if Hillary had won the office, there would still be 37 million people without health care. Yeah. We still would have to face the fact that 50 years after the first Poor People's Campaign, there is much left to be done.
All righty, there you go. So I would now like to welcome our guests and to have them return to Sojourner Truth. I'll first like to welcome Ashley Henderson. She describes herself as a Black Appalachian working class woman born and raised in Southeast Tennessee. She is the first Black woman to serve as the co-executive director of the Highlander Research and Education Center and is an active participant in the movement for Black Lives. She has extensive experience with community organizing and is a former staff member of the Chicago Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee's History Project and a past member of United Students Against Sweatshops National Coordinating. Ashley Henderson, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Gwendolyn Zohara Simmons, currently a senior lecturer of religion and affiliated faculty at the Women's Studies Department at the University of Florida. She also is really an icon in the civil rights era. She was active with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and she has continued her activism throughout her life. Gwendolyn Zohara Simmons, welcome.
Thank you.
All righty. So you heard those clips. First one from Bayard Rustin talking about morality and social ethics and the United States, and on Mario Savio, whose voice really became an echo of the free speech at the beginnings of the anti-war movement. That was mainly a white movement, although not only, because SNCC and others also came out against the war. Fast forward to today with the voter suppression, as expressed by that 92-year-old woman in Georgia and Reverend Barber of the New Poor People's Campaign. And I wondered if you wanted to comment, and Ashley, maybe starting with you, commenting on, because there were different errors and different movements there, and I wondered if you wanted to comment on it.
Sure. I mean, having been in Georgia on Election Day, I can't tell you how often we heard stories of people who were doing everything in their power to make sure that they got to participate in this one tactic towards their own liberation by voting. I think what these clips make super clear is that if the tactic of voting didn't matter, they wouldn't be doing everything in their power to keep Black people from it for generations, right? And I think that the contemporary Black liberation movement of the 21st century recognizes that electoral justice is actually a key tool in our toolbox, and that if we don't use it, that it will backtrack us, and we cannot afford that, that Black people's lives need and deserve more from our elected officials, and that we intend to continue to support candidates who run on movement platforms and are accountable to our people and communities. So I think these clips are critical to my understanding of the ongoing work to fight against voter suppression, to fight for people's right to vote, and proud to be one in a great cloud of witnesses that are continuing to, in Florida and Mississippi and Georgia, demand that every vote be counted.
Yeah, and Ashley, also, I wanted you to comment on it. I mean, I'm quite struck, too, with talking with, I suppose, Generation Z people, even some millennials who really are not as aware as one would hope, or I certainly would have hoped, about the civil rights era. People who don't know who Fannie Lou Hamer is, people who don't know who Bayard Rustin is, and not, you know, and also understanding about the first Reconstruction and the destruction of it, and what that meant, and that whole Jim Crow era. So this being a cross-generational conversation, we'll have Zahara weigh in on this in a moment, but how important to you, you're a part of the movement for Black Lives and a lot of organizing with young people. I wanted your thought on it, and what do you think can be done, and what your feeling of some of the tensions also over that history, because I know they are some. I remember when we, and myself being part of that movement, saying, well, we can't trust anybody over 30, right? And I wonder if there is some of that going around in the movements we're seeing coming up right now, Ashley.
Yeah, you know, I think it's an interesting question. It's a question that I get often. As a 33-year-old executive director of an 86-year-old institution, that trains, where many of the people that are my mentors trained in how to be excellent in their craft towards organizing and direct action. And
you're referring to Highlander, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. The one and only Highlander Folk School that we now belovedly call the Highlander Research and Education Center. You know, that even that name change only happened because the state of Tennessee shut us down for having folks like yourselves, you know, together in our space. And so I think that, like, it's interesting to continuously get this question, particularly thinking about how I hold the past, present, and future kind of all at once by being a steward of that place. And that intergenerational organizing is one of seven methodologies that we continue to make people to help support people's competency in. It's also interesting to me in the context of when I think about the program work of many of the organizations of the Movement for Black Lives, right? When you think about Southerners on New Ground and how they have a Bayard Rustin celebration every year. That when you think about one of their newest programs, it's a leadership development program called The Lord's Work, right? It's named after Audre Lorde. Mm-hmm. When I think about the Highlander Center, how we have a building that we're building in 2019 named after Septima Clark, right? It's just, I don't know that I actually am drinking the Kool-Aid that Generation C or millennial folks or Oregon Trail generation folks, whichever of the many you want to call us, that we don't actually desire a relationship with our elders. Zahara and I were just talking before the show about how I was just with the National Council of Elders, and in fact had facilitated their meetings for years when I was still staff at Project South, and how much of a desire from the elders there was to be in right relationship with the young people, and how often they were getting to spend time with young people that were thirsty for their comradeship, for their kinship, and for their mentorship. And so although I do think that there can be political difference among folks of different generations, just like there's political differences between people in the same generation, right? We're not monolithic. I don't think that that's just because of age. I think lastly, I would say that for folks that may be young folks in particular that feel frustrated by some of our elders, I think, again, it's typically not because of apathy, just like I don't think people don't vote because of apathy. I think that's a misnomer. What I do believe is that we have been taught a whitewashed version of our own history. And I think that the more that places like Highlander, places like institutions like the National Council of Elders and others can continue to remember our communities across these generational gaps, the more that we'll see that, like, we're in this work together. I don't think you can look at the Poor People's Campaign and not see an intergenerational movement. You most definitely cannot look at the Movement for Black Lives and not see an intergenerational movement. You can't look at the work of the majority and not see an intergenerational movement. So I think that there's more, obviously, always going to be more work to do to bring more of our people around the table with each other and to build the muscle of active solidarity across generations. But I actually think that the intergenerational organizing is something that many of us are thirsty for, regardless of the generation that we belong to.
Right. And of course, the Highlander Research and Education Center in New Market, Tennessee, works with people fighting for justice, equality, and sustainability using popular education, language justice, participatory research. I like that, participatory research, cultural work, and intergenerational organizing to create educational spaces for activists and foster movements for social, economic, and restorative environmental change. And as Ashley, who is now the co-executive director of that institute, says, it was founded way back in 1932 and continuing that work. So Zahara Simmons, bringing you into this discussion, you definitely were right in the midst, in the heart of the civil rights era. You were in the South with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, where so many of you faced really threats on your life, beatings, jails, and others. And I just wanted, first of all, for you to give a sense, before we talk about the intergenerational piece, right, to give our listeners a sense of what it was really like in that era. How did you all survive? How did you keep your spirits up? How did you pick yourself up after a killing or after a defeat to go on to the next? Gwendolyn Zahara Simmons.
Well, thank you for having me on the program, and I'm so happy to be in conversation with both of you, particularly Ashley, who gives me so much hope. I tell her that all the time when I see her, because, you know, we're not passing the torch. We're joining torches as we move on, and, of course, as we old ones fall, knowing that the young ones will keep going forward, gives me so much hope.
Yeah.
In terms of, I just walked upstairs from a class on the civil rights movement that I'm teaching, and, you know, I don't get much of a rise out of those young people. They sort of make me feel, what does it take to get you all worked up? Because we had just heard Miss Fannie Lou Hamer give a gripping description, which was a part of her speech at the August 1964 Democratic National Convention, where the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party delegation was challenging the all-white racist Mississippi regulars to replace them. And a part of her testimony to the delegates was about the terrible beating she received in Winona, Mississippi. She and Annell Ponder, another name we must lift up and never forget, they were beaten brutally because they had tried to register to vote. So to say how, I mean, we lived under white terror. We didn't even have some of the vocabulary then that we have now to describe. It was state-sponsored terrorism. And we had vigilantes, the Klan, and other groups, as well as the elected officials, the sheriffs, the constables. They all wanted to kill us. So you had no, you know, the Klan was coming. Many of the people with the robes on were the sheriffs, were the constables. We were, you know, in a terrible situation. When I went to Mississippi, and having grown up in Memphis, Tennessee, in the Jim Crow era, I certainly knew that we lived under unbridled white power. We had no, I grew up when there was not one elected black official. There was, even though we could vote in Memphis, Tennessee, we could not run for office. So there were, everybody was white. The police, the judges, you know, you name it. And we basically had to do what those people said. But going to Mississippi, where we were told by those who had formed the Mississippi Freedom, Freedom Summer, 1964 Mississippi Freedom Summer, that they had already said they were going to kill us. And before I even stepped into the state, Schwerna, Goodman, and Cheney had disappeared. I was still at the orientation session.
Oh my goodness.
When we were called in and told that those three had disappeared. Well, I had waved Cheney and Goodman off because I was there for both weeks and had watched them board the bus leaving Oxford, Ohio, en route to Mississippi. And to be told a few days later that they had disappeared and for us to be assured that they were dead, that there was no way that they could be missing. So even before I went, I knew what was waiting for us, and I was scared. And, of course, I went against my parents' wishes. They did everything in their power to stop me from going because they said, they're going to kill a bunch of you down there. And my grandmother, in her effort to stop me, she said, and before they kill you, they're going to gang rape you. So this was the image. I left Memphis home on my way to Mississippi, to Oxford, Ohio, with people put everything on the line. I lived for 2 years rent-free in the home of Missy Berta Spinks in Laurel, Mississippi. She had a what was then for black people a quite a nice home. And for her to open up her home, she housed three of us, two white women and myself, for 2 years. And she sat every night with her shotgun across her lap and told us that we could sleep because nobody was coming in her house to get us. So this, you know, what these people went through, I mean, we could go home, but they were at home. And they were putting everything on the line for the right to vote, for the right to be engaged in the politics that determine their lives. And this is what I try to stress with the students. Please don't take voting for granted. I mean, please don't take the fact that you're sitting in this majority white college for granted. People died for you to be able to do this. And you're just so lackadaisical about it. You're not voting. You're not involved. I mean, you know, I just preached a sermon down there this morning because I learned that only 18% of black registered voters in the state of Florida voted in the midterm elections. So I'm in a pretty worked up state right now.
Yeah, and thank you for that, Gwendolyn Zahara Simmons. You know, it is so emotional listening to you. I know you know my cousin Martha Prescott Noonan, and I love just listening to Martha and one story she tells of her and others from SNCC being in a church, and you were multiracial, you were black and white and brown people. And you were surrounded by racists, surrounded by the Klan, and had no idea if, you know, she and others would get out of this church alive. But that is just the level of commitment that people had, and somehow you managed to keep going, which is just amazing. What we're going to do now, and indeed, we have to take a short break so stations could identify themselves, and then we're going to continue this discussion. But I want to, the music of the movement was so important then, you know, getting people through so many horrors, just as it got us through the horrors of the slave days and beyond. So let us hear the voice now of Bernice Reagan Johnson.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
Oh, how can you rest?
We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. Until the killing of black men, black mothers, sons, is as important as the killing of white men, white mothers, sons.
She's with us.
We who believe in freedom. We who believe in freedom, the older I get, the better I know that the secret to my going on is when the razor in the hands of the healthy
And that is indeed Bernice Johnson Reagan, who went on to found Sweet Honey in the Rock, and she herself was with SNCC and a civil rights activist out of Albany, Georgia. Another Georgia person there. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you are a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. You could also check out our website at www.sotrueradio.org. On Instagram, we are at SoTrueRadio. And we are also on SoundCloud in the U.S. and also internationally. Today, we'd like to give a shout out to all of our listeners who were active in the civil rights era across the United States and internationally. I want to give a shout out to my home island of Barbados that just elected its first woman prime minister this past spring. And we are having an in-depth conversation with two activists from different eras, although they overlap. Gwendolyn Zohara Simmons, who was active with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the South during the Civil Rights era, but she has continued her activism up until this very moment. And Ashley Henderson, an Afro-Latian, she calls herself a Black Appalachian, working class, born and raised in Southeast Tennessee, first Black woman to serve as the co-executive director of the Highlander Research and Education Center, and is part, an active participant in the movement for Black lives. And she also served as a former staff member of the Chicago Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee's History Project and past member of United Students Against Sweatshops National Coordinating. So, Ashley, back to you. Just heard Zohara describe, you know, what it was like. Zohara, I know it's hard to talk about, but I am glad that you did talk about it. And there's a little bit different than I'm hearing. I'm hearing from you that the young people that you have been involved with and teaching now as students are not particularly interested in that history of the civil rights era, and that indeed in the recent midterm elections that happened in fall of 2018, only 18% of Black voters across Florida participated. And this was considered a key election with a Black man on the ticket. And Ashley Henderson, I heard you saying earlier that you have found that younger folks are either engaged or really do want to know what's going on, and that perhaps there is that view out there that this is really not the case. But it does seem to me as though some coming together needs to happen, because Ashley, last time we spoke on the air, you said you can't shame people into voting. I think you're right about that. I would agree about that. I've tried, okay? and it just doesn't work. I think we all have. So the thing is that what we do know is that voting is just a piece of what Black people have used, right? And other people have used to try and get some freedom. But we also know that building a movement on the ground from the bottom up is what's needed. But there have been a lot of problems with that movement coming together, right? And just from your perspective, Ashley Henderson, just your response to some of what Zohara said earlier, but also what do you see now as some of the barriers that get in the way of that coming together?
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously, and I've said this on the show before when I was blessed to be able to be on with Zohara, that, like, you know, what she says, I believe, you know, I hear. What I also know to be true about Zohara Simmons is that she spends time with incredible young people like the Dream Defenders, who critical to Andrew Gillum's success so far, and involved in the fight to get people to the polls to vote for Amendment 4, which hopefully will mean that we don't lose another election in the state of Florida ever again, re-enfranchising hundreds of thousands of formerly and currently incarcerated people, following in the footsteps of folks like Kenneth Blasco and the Ordinary People Society in Alabama. I think that we tell young people and poor people and rural people and all the marginalized folks a lot of different messages, right? We tell them the system is broken, and then a week later we'll say the system is working exactly how it's supposed to, and it's disenfranchising our people, right? We'll tell them that their one vote matters, and then we'll call them and phone bank them, we'll text them, we'll knock on their door and tell them that we're in the fight of our lives to get their vote to be counted before our candidates can see, before right-wing candidates that are white nationalists and white supremacists that don't like our people and will use policy to harm our communities claim their own victories, right? And so I think that until we have a clarity of vision and message It doesn't shock me when people are like, yo, this doesn't make sense, right? I think that what I've gotten to see is that the folks that are running the campaigns of the most transformative politics agreeing to candidates are young people, right? The folks that are involved in the Gillum campaign, the folks that are involved in Stacey Abrams' campaign, and not just the incredible intergenerational collective of volunteers that have been throwing down work, but I'm talking about the people that are eating pizza three times a day and counting ballots all day long, who are tracking down every single vote that they can find, paper ballots all over state, are younger people. And so I just don't believe this idea that young people are not engaged, because I'm literally seeing them. If you go on social media and you check out the hashtag count every vote, what you'll see is young people engaging, right? Now, obviously, digital organizing doesn't take the place of good old-fashioned door knocking. But what I can tell you is that I'm also seeing intergenerationally folks coming together to do that work too. Is it to scale? Absolutely not. Is there more work to do? Always. Always, always, always. But I can't imagine what it'll be for me to have to door knock a young person to go to a youth groups meeting and talk to them about the importance of voting, about how their vote matters, about how their vote counts, when we are literally the literal focus of what's happening in Florida and Georgia and places like Mississippi right now is demanding that the state count the vote, right? So I just think that there is some intentionality around tactics and an intentionality around demand that's going to be critical moving forward. You know, our hope and prayer is that we'll get to these runoffs and we will win them, and these movement candidates will get in the seats, and we will be able to hold them accountable because we've built people power. But even then, if all we fight for is for fair counts, right, and not just that everybody, that by the time they're 18, or if you look at some of the leadership of folks on the West Coast, by the time they're 16 are automatically registered to vote, period, right? That folks that are formerly and currently incarcerated still deserve to be able to vote, period, right? If we don't make those transformative demands, we'll end up right back in this seat in 2020. And I think that that's actually a big thing to be thinking about right now, right? It's like, as we're continuing to try to wrap up these elections, and hopefully in ways that benefit the material conditions of our people, that we also have to be looking forward to the next cycle and not just waiting. You know, foundations and philanthropy have been waiting to the very last minute to make investments in our communities, right? Like, it is not unusual for Black communities not to receive financial support to get out the vote until 6 weeks before an election. That is not acceptable, right? It is not acceptable for the Democratic Party to only come and knock on our doors when they've got their hands out around voting time, right? We are seeing over and over again that the Democratic Party's insistency on catering to a conservative center at best and flat out conservatives at worst is not going to be the name of the game anymore, right? That Stacey Abrams and Andrew Gillum actually spoke to the best of us. And if we continue to work down that strategy, we could really transform what electoral justice looks like in this country. We could actually, for maybe the first time in my lifetime, get a glimpse of what democratic government can look like, not just our own internal communal democratic governance, right? Self-determination. So I think there's plenty of things in this flawed system to be criticized. I don't and I won't ever just blame our communities who are under-resourced, who are not educated on civics, who are not honestly given candidates very often that are worth their investment. I'll never blame them what I think is a systemic problem.
Right. And to go to you, Zahara, to get some response from you.
Yes.
But two things to consider, and I want to put in here. Ashley talked about the clarity of vision and message, okay? Now, we are living under great repression, under capitalism, not only in this country, but also internationally. I don't know that given the situation right now, that we actually can know what we want freedom or democracy to look like. We know that we want to be free. We know that we want to be to end up with this, you know, oppression that we're facing us. But it does seem to me as though it is an ongoing project. And that clarity and the vision that Ashley is talking about, we are working. It's a daily work, right? There is no blueprint for it. That's one thing I wanted to say about it. But I know you're dying to jump in here, Zahara. But speaking of clarity, I just wanted, or anger of youth, I wanted to just share with our audience and with you, Dave Dennis, and a speech he gave after Medgar Evers, that civil rights worker head of the NAACP, was assassinated. And Zahara, then you go for it.
Okay.
I'm not here to do the traditional thing most of us do at such a gathering. And that is of telling what a great person the individual was, some of the great works that the person was involved in, and etc. I think we all know, because he walked these dusty streets of Meridian and around here long before I came here, with you and around you, played with your kids, and he talked to all of you. What I want to talk about is really what I really grieve about. I don't grieve for Cheney because of the fact I feel that he lived a fuller life than many of us would ever live.
Oh, this was after Cheney.
I feel that he's gotten his freedom. Amen. And we're still fighting for it. Amen. But what I want to talk about right now is the living debt that we have right among
we
our midst.
We can fix it. I'll correct it.
Not only in the state of Mississippi, but throughout the nation. Those are the people who don't care. Those who do care but don't have the guts enough to stand up for it. And those people who are busy up in Washington and other places using my freedom and my life to play politics with. That includes the president on down to the governor of the state of Mississippi, you see. In my opinion, as I stand here, I not only blame the people who pulled the trigger, or did the beating, or dug the hole with the shovel. I bury the people, not bury, sorry. But I blame the people in Washington, D.C., and on down in the state of Mississippi for what happened just as much as I blame those who pulled the trigger. Because I feel that 100 years ago, if the proper thing had been done by the federal government of this particular country, and by the other people, responsible people or irresponsible, whatever you want to call them, of the nation, we wouldn't be here today to mourn the death of a brave young man like James Cheney, you see. As I stand here, a lot of things pass through my mind. I can remember the Emmett Till case, what happened to him, and what happened to the people who killed him. They're walking the streets right now, and the brother one is a police officer in a place called Ruleville, Mississippi. I can remember back down here, right below us here, a man by the name of Max Parker, and exactly what happened to him, and what happened to the people who beat, killed him, and drug him down the streets and threw him in the river. I know that those people were caught, but they were never brought to trial. I can remember back in Birmingham, the four young kids who were bombed in the church when they just went to service. And I know what has happened to the people who killed them. Nothing. Remember the little 13-year-old kid who was riding a bicycle who was shot in the back? And the youth who shot him, who was a white guy in Birmingham, got off with 3 months. I can remember all of that right now. I can remember the Medgar Evers case in Beckwith. The person who was governor of the state at that particular time going up and shaking his hand when the jury said that it could not come to a verdict. I can remember all of that. Yeah. And I can remember down
can
in the southwest area where
we've
had six Negroes who've been killed. And I can remember the Lees and all these particular people, and know what has happened to those who have been killing them. I know what's happened to the people who've been bombing the churches, who've been bombing the homes, who are doing the beatings around this entire state and country. Yeah. And I'm getting sick and tired. I'm sick and tired of going to memorials. I'm sick and tired of going to funerals. I've got a bitter vengeance in my heart tonight. And I'm sick and tired, and I can't help but feel bitter, you see. Deep down inside, and I'm not going to stand here and ask anybody in here not to be angry tonight. Yeah, we have love in our heart, and we've had it for years and years in this country. We've died on the battlefield to protect the people in this country. We've gone out and went once. 1942, millions of us died too, you see. We were out there standing. We have people in this country today with no eyes, without a leg, without an arm, to defend this country and to come back to do what? To live as slaves, you see. I'm sick and tired of that.
Sick and tired of that, Zahara. Dave sounds pretty clear to me.
Yes, dear Dave, Dennis, a comrade and friend. I certainly agree with my comrade, Ashley. You know, I don't blame our people, but I do blame myself and those of us who have been in the struggle. You know, it's something to be looking back at 56 years of activism, which is what I'm doing. So to have been in the sit-ins, to have been in Mississippi for Mississippi Freedom Summer and months beyond, to have been in Atlanta with the Atlanta Project of SNCC working and developing the first position paper on Black Power, to be working to keep Black men from going to Vietnam, to, you know, be involved with all of our campaigns for independent Black education, for running the first Black people that ran for office in Atlanta and Cleveland, and you have it. I am quite clear, I think, about what we didn't do, and I understand why we didn't do it, because first of all, there was COINTELPRO, the government's plan to stop the movement, either through assassination of our leaders, through the planting of what do you call those people, agents provocateurs in our organizations, so that they could plant drugs and guns and wind up getting many of our people killed and or locked up for years. We know how many of the Panthers were either killed or locked up, some of them just now getting out 50 years later, et cetera. So I'm real clear that there was repression that came out to kill the movement. At the same time, I am sad that somehow we did not persevere in spite of that, and of course many did. Many have stayed on the battlefield and never left. But we do not have the mass involvement that we had earlier. And yes, we have incredible young people like yourself and the people who started the Black Lives Movement, and I was so fortunate to be here in Florida with the early Dream Defenders movement. And I know that there are other movements, Black Youth 100 and all the movement for Black Lives. But somehow we have got to, across generational lines, come put our heads together on how do we get to the grassroots. I mean, the grassroots from where I sit have not been activated again as they were earlier. I see so much depression. I see people having to work so hard just to keep body and soul together. I see the destruction of our children in the public school system. I understand why our children don't know, our young people don't know any of this history, because it's been purposely kept from them. I have been involved in the last 5 years here in Alachua County, as well as Florida, and in the whole state of Florida, working to get African American history taught in our schools.
Yeah.
It is a battle. I mean, these people do not want it. So what are we doing here locally? We, in the last two elections, ran black people for the school board, because the school board is a big block to our being able to get real black history taught in our schools other than during Black History Month. And so here comes politics. We lost last 2 years ago, but this year we got one of our fighters for equity in a black education elected to the school board. That's just one.
Well, on that note, I can't believe that we are out of time. We might need to have a part two. We might need to have a part two of this, y'all. It's just been incredible.
I'd love to. Okay.
Yeah, Ashley Henderson, Gwendolyn Zahara Simmons, thank you so very much for joining us. Appreciate
you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Margaret. I love you, Zahara.
Okay.
I love you more.
Okay. Alrighty. A lot of love going there. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank our Sojourner Truth team, our intern, Julianne Tweeten, and our assistant producer, Ramiro Funes. Thank you for listening. This is your host.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got 4 requests for this thing already today. Strutting right there.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A.